Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241, and it's the February, what day of February? 22nd. It seems like we just left class, and we just walked right back in because we didn't come on Friday or Monday. Hope you all had a good break. All right, so let's just go back and review a couple things from Chapter 4 before we go on to Chapter 5. And I want to show you this slide right here. It's one of the first slides, very important. You can look at this when you answer numerous questions online. But remember how we wrote an equation, a chemical equation on the board. Let's write an equation on the board. So what's a typical kind of chemical reaction? We've got what? A plus B and an arrow going to C plus D. All right, so what do we call these things on the left-hand side? These are substrates if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. Otherwise, we're just going to call it reactants, right? Substrates are reactants right here. And what is formed? These are the products. All right, and all of these molecules have energy associated with them that we call free energy. And we can just add these things up. Basically, we can calculate, we can measure the free energy if we take a molecule and burn it in a, what we call a calorimeter, and measure how much heat comes off of that reaction. We can actually measure the energy. And these things are well known, so we don't have to do that anymore. We can just look them up in a book and find out what the free energy is. And in this particular reaction, all right, that I have on this slide, I've got reactants. Well, we got a plot about energy versus kind of like time over here. And so energy is on the vertical scale. What has more energy, reactants or the products, in this reaction that I have on the graph? Yeah, the reactants have much more energy, right? And the products have less. So here we have A and B. These are physical things that we can look at, right? They're physical entities, but there also is something else that's a physical entity. But we can't really weigh it, right? We can't look at it. We can't hold it and touch it and move it around, right? But it's something just as real, and that is energy, right? So in this equation, that chemical equation we wrote on the board, if it is this one that's on the graph, right, we should put energy on this diagram as well because it's a physical thing, right? And where would we want to put that in this chemical reaction? On the, should we put it with substrates or should we put it with products? Okay. What has less energy? Yeah, the products have less energy than the reactants, but remember, what does that first law of thermodynamics say? Energy can either be created or destroyed. All right, so if A plus B has more energy than C plus D, and we can't destroy energy, where does energy belong on this equation? It's a product of the reaction, right? So we need to put something else over here, plus energy. Some energy is released. All right, so that's just what the first law of thermodynamics states. We can't lose energy. Plus, in lab, you talked about what's the delta G for this reaction right here? Is it negative or positive? It's going to be negative, right? So this is going to be a negative delta G because it's giving off energy. What's another way of saying negative delta G? It is what? Exergonic. Right? It's an exergonic reaction. And so that energy can be used for various kinds of purposes. All right, so what is a good definition of energy? It's kind of an ethereal thing, but it's really important for us because the best definition of energy is that it's something that allows work to take place. All right, so energy is just an entity that allows work to happen. Okay, so here we have a nice exergonic reaction on this graph. And it's releasing energy, and if this graph had numbers on it, we could actually calculate the negative delta G for this particular reaction. All right, what does the second law of thermodynamics say? And I'm going to flip through a number of slides right here to get to some other slides that I want to look at. What's the second law of thermodynamics? Energy, can be transferred, right, but it can't be created. Oh, well, that's actually part of the first law. Okay, that's part of the first law. So here we have CO2 plus water making this glucose molecule. Now this is We have CO2 really low on the delta free energy scale and glucose really high on the energy scale. So what kind of reaction is this in terms of delta G, positive or negative? That's a positive delta G. Okay, so let's just write this down. We got CO2 plus water going to glucose. All right, what else is on there? Oh yeah, plus oxygen. Now that's always a good thing. All right, I'm not going to balance the equation out because I don't want to take the time to do that. Okay, oxygen, that's a byproduct of the reaction. But what is missing on this equation right here? Energy. Where should we put energy? On the left or on the right? It's on the left because it's one of the reactants, right? So we're going to put energy in order to get this thing to go. All right, and so plants, where do plants get this energy from? Yeah, it gets it from the sun. Right, so energy can be converted from one form to another, but can't be created or destroyed. So can you give me an example of taking electrical energy and converting it into mechanical energy? What would do that? What kind of system would do that? Some people thinking of that. Like what do you use to start your car? Most of you have gas engines or diesel engines or something like that. So you use energy that's stored in your battery, right? And that energy then is transferred to the little electric motor on your car that spins your car engine around, and that's how you start your car. So that would be a way of converting electrical energy to mechanical energy, getting the car engine to move around. What's another way of transducing energy? Who can think of another way that you can convert one form of energy into another form? Chemical to mechanical. Oh, for instance, like what kind of chemical energy? This has got to be your favorite molecule. Like what? ATP, for instance. Using ATP to cause a muscle to contract. And you learned a little bit about that in anatomy, right? Forming of the cross bridges, the sliding of the myofilaments. So that's converting chemical energy into mechanical energy. Once again. Okay, what about converting light energy into chemical energy? Not in terms of a plant, but for you. What can do that? Oh, your skin. Ah, yeah, your skin can absorb, because it has pigments, can absorb light energy, and it can cause rearrangements of molecules inside your body. Sometimes that's beneficial in the sense of vitamin D. Okay, but your eyes can convert light energy into electrical energy or chemical energy inside of your brain. Okay? So you have little photoreceptors there. Lights are good for, light is good for making images. We don't know how, our eyes can't make energy molecules like glucose, like a plant can. They can't convert that much energy. All right? So just think of converting one form of energy to another. Chemical energy into thermal energy. You know, like a flame whenever you burn something. So energy can be converted one way or the other. But think of energy as actually being an important property of a chemical reaction. Okay, and it's either going to be consumed or released unless what happens? And we're going to go back to this chart right here. Unless the reactants have the same energy as the products right here. And then if that's the case, then that's a freely reversible chemical reaction. It can go back and forth. Okay, and then what determines what direction this arrow is going to be drawn as? It's going to be determined by the concentrations. If we increase the concentration of A or B, it's going to force the reaction to the right. All right, if we decrease the concentrations of either A or B, the reaction is going to go to the left. All right. Conversely, if we increase C and D, that will force the reaction to the left, or if we decrease the products, that forces the reaction to the right. And does anybody know what that law is called? Law of mass action. Yeah, or Le Chatelier's principle. All right, so those are some of the important take-home messages of this lecture. Okay. So let's finish up just by looking at this slide again. So here we have a molecule with high delta free energy. Then we're back down here with CO2 and water, very low free energy. and there can be a series of chemical reactions. What do we call a series of chemical reactions? It's a metabolic pathway. So these would all be intermediates that we haven't drawn in right here, but we're going to look at some of these intermediates in the next chapter. All right, so if the products have a lot less energy than the reactants, what happens to that energy? Does it get lost? Does it go away? No, it stays in the universe, and then it can be used to do a number of things. It could heat something up, or it can be used to make other kinds of reactions happen, chemical reactions. Right? And for instance, if this was your automobile, then that heat would be used to drive pistons up and down, so that energy could be converted into mechanical energy. But in living systems, this energy right here is just to maintain body temperature, but also to drive other kinds of chemical reactions that need energy. So what kind of reactions need energy? We've got two choices, this top line or this bottom line. What kinds of reactions need energy? The top line right here, okay, and what would be the delta G for that? That's a positive delta G, and we call that what? Endergonic. That's an endergonic reaction. So endergonic reactions can certainly take place as long as there is a source of energy to drive it. Okay, so that's going to take us to, I think, the next chapter. Okay, so here is ATP molecule. All right, so what about this reaction right here? It's drawn kind of in a vertical way, not a horizontal way. But if we have adenosine diphosphate plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP, what kind of reaction is that? Exergonic or endergonic? Okay. Where would we want to actually draw energy in on this equation right here? It would have to be above the arrow. So adenosine diphosphate plus inorganic phosphate plus energy, right, would make ATP. Right, because now we're building this big molecule from two small ones that takes energy. That energy ends up right here in this bond. That's a high energy bond. Okay? But now let's go and we're going to look and see where some of that energy comes from. All right, so ADP plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP is endergonic. It requires energy from someplace, right? And we're going to see where that comes. You know an organelle that's famous for doing this. What's the organelle that's famous for making ATP? Mitochondria. Okay, so we're going to look at some of those processes. All right, and then whenever your cell needs energy, hopefully it's a nice, healthy cell. There's plenty of ATP, and that energy is found in this chemical bond. So then, let's go back the other way. If we have ATP and going to inorganic phosphate and adenosine diphosphate, where would you put energy? And what would be that reaction? Would it be endergonic or exergonic? ATP going to ADP. Exergonic, because it's going to release energy that was in this chemical bond. Right, so we want to put energy up over here, just the exact same place. Right, but then that would be an exergonic reaction with minus delta G. Okay, so you could actually think of ATP as being a coenzyme. What the heck is a coenzyme? What was something else that we learned about? There's two co's that we learned last time. There's a coenzyme and a cofactor. Which one was a real simple metal ion? The cofactor. Where is that at? Cofactor. It's back here someplace. Okay. I don't know. You can find it in your notes someplace. Someplace right in here. Right here. Cofactors and coenzymes. All right. So cofactors are things that can change the shape of an enzyme, speed up the rate of a reaction when it binds to an enzyme, but it's going to bind to just a small spot on the enzyme. Okay. A coenzyme is used to transport something from one set of chemical reactions to another. So it can transport maybe some molecules, but it can also transport something else. And in the terms of ATP, what's it transporting from one set of reactions to another? ATP is actually transferring energy, so you could think of ATP as being I really flipped too far. Where did we go? Okay. You could really think of ATP as being a coenzyme. It's a large organic molecule, and what it's transporting is what? Energy from one set of reactions to another to make some endergonic reactions take place, like, for instance, muscle contraction. All right, what are some other coenzymes that we looked at? Some things that are kind of similar, okay, like, for instance, NAD. Your book is a little sloppy sometimes in how it writes NAD. It's really an ion. All right. Oh, I wish I could just double-click that, but I guess I'm going to have to make it bigger so you can see. All right, so here is NAD, and it's correctly written on this slide. It's NAD what? It's an ion. It's a monovalent cation, right? So NAD. That is a coenzyme. And what is it carrying? It is carrying high-energy electrons that can bind, right? Right in this region right here. So it can accept two high-energy electrons and a proton. So that negates one positive charge, and a proton and an electron cancel each other out. So NADH is a neutral molecule. It's not an ion. All right, so NAD can flip back and forth from an oxidized state to a reduced state because something becomes reduced when what happens? When it accepts electrons from some other molecule. Right? So NADH is the reduced form. And the other molecule, a big organic molecule, is FAD. It's not an ion. It accepts two electrons and two protons, but it's carrying two high-energy electrons from one set of metabolic reactions to another, right? And it becomes FADH2. And you can see these are kind of similar. They're all built on a nucleotide basis, right? It almost looks like an adenine right here. All right. So then that was the last topic that we talked about was this oxidation-reduction reaction. When a molecule receives electrons, it becomes reduced. And when it gives electrons away, that molecule is oxidized. And it always works together. You need, in order for a molecule to become reduced, another molecule has to become oxidized. So we call it an oxidation-reduction reaction. All right, so that's it for Chapter 4. Anybody have any questions on Chapter 4? Yes. Okay, I'm missing the question just a little bit, so just really speak right down at me so I don't hear too many echoes.
All I found on this NADH-FADH reaction was in a Krebs cycle. Can you give me an example of someone else that you
used? Yeah, I'm going to give you a number of them, okay, because there are many times when we want to oxidize a molecule, change its form, and so in order to, or reduce the molecule, then we want NADH to reduce it, or if we want to oxidize a molecule, we want NAD plus around to oxidize a molecule. And I'll give you a really good example of where that happens besides the Krebs cycle. Okay. Yeah, so we're going to talk about those. So really, really important pathways right here. Okay. Okay, so let's move on to Chapter 5. All right, so cell respiration and metabolism. Respiration right here has a couple meanings. One meaning of respiration is just in a gross anatomy form where you actually inhale and exhale, when we actually ventilate. So ventilation and respiration sometimes are used synonymously for breathing. Okay, but when we say cell respiration, that means something completely different. It's not just ventilating your lungs, but it has to do with the biochemistry inside cells and how that drives metabolism. All right, so we're going to talk about these pathways right here, glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and then fat metabolism, and probably not protein metabolism, but we'll talk about fat metabolism. All right, so what the heck is metabolism? Metabolism is just all of the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body at any particular time. So thousands of reactions taking place. So can you hear me in the back? How's that microphone level? Pretty good? Better? Is it on? Sounds like it went off. No, it's on. Okay. All right, so there we go. So metabolism is just all the chemical reactions taking place in your body. And then previously we learned that there are two basic kinds of reactions. There are some reactions that break large molecules down into smaller ones. So that's a subset of metabolism. We call those catabolic reactions. Right? And catabolic reactions, when you have a big molecule broken down into smaller ones, that releases energy. So what kind of reaction is that that releases energy? That's an exergonic reaction. So that is the second line that I have on the board. Here is some, you could consider this catabolism, where maybe A dash B are put together and then it's broken down into two smaller products that releases energy. Right? And then what do you have left over? Something that you can work with. You have energy. Right? So catabolism releases energy. So catabolic reactions that break down large molecules into smaller ones release energy, and then that energy can be used to make ATP. Right? So that's a really important concept. Anabolism, on the other hand, makes large molecules from smaller ones, right? So anabolism takes smaller molecules and makes large molecules out of it, and that requires energy to form that. All right, so one would be a synthesis reaction and one would be a hydrolysis reaction from what we talked about before. All right, which one of these would be a hydrolysis reaction? Hydrolysis is what, catabolism or anabolism? Catabolism, okay. And then a synthesis reaction would be anabolism, right? All right, so if you want to store energy, an anabolic reaction is what is used to store energy because it's going to take energy and put it into chemical bonds for storage. But if energy is needed, then chemicals have to be broken down. All right, so for instance, if you want to make ATP, molecules have to be broken down to make ATP, and then if a set of reactions requires energy to work, then the cell uses the energy trapped in ATP to make those reactions work. All right, so that is metabolism. Here is a really good slide, and I wanted to get a copy to put over on the other screen and just keep it on the other screen the whole time. So for the rest of the chapter, I want you to relate everything to this diagram that we're going to be looking at right here. All right, so here is metabolism. So let's look at this slide for a little bit. We have some organ system right here, which is the digestive system. Here we see the stomach and small intestine, and the job of this digestive system is to absorb nutrients into our body, right, as well as to digest complex molecules. And what we absorb is glucose, and where does it end up? It ends up, what does this represent right here? This is your circulatory system, right, so that's just a blood vessel. Right, so we have the digestive system putting glucose into the blood. Now, when does that happen? That happens when we are in what we call a fed state. Right, so when we're in a fed state, our blood glucose is maintained by absorbing glucose from the nutrients that we ate. Right, now, as opposed to being in a fed state, we could also be in an opposite state. That opposite state is called a fasting state. So when are you in a fasting state? Like when you wake up first thing in the morning, for sure, right? Because you haven't eaten anything for hours and hours and hours. There are no nutrients left in the digestive tract, so glucose cannot enter the blood. But, you know, it's really important to maintain blood glucose levels within a normal range. So there is an organ, when we're in a fasted state, that can put glucose in the blood, and that is the liver. So when you're in a fed state, glucose enters the blood from food that you ate. When you're in a fasted state, glucose is maintained by the liver. And what could you tell me about glycogen? We talked about glycogen. What's the building block of glycogen? It's glucose. It's a monosaccharide, so the liver can take glycogen and break it down little unit by unit and put that glucose into the blood. All right, so then that glucose goes everywhere in the body. And when there is a proper signal, it can enter a cell. So that's what this area here represents. It's kind of like a dull beige color to me that is inside the cell. So it's been transported inside the cell. It can only get inside the cell if there's an insulin signal. When we get into the endocrine system, we'll talk about that. So glucose just can't willy-nilly enter a cell. There's got to be insulin available. But it enters the cell, and it's in the cytoplasm. And there it can be broken down. And this first process right here, you should think of it as taking glucose and snipping it in half. How many carbon atoms make up glucose? Six. So if we snip it in half, how many carbon atoms are left? You've got two molecules that have three carbon atoms in it, and that molecule is what we call pyruvic acid. All right? And since we're breaking glucose down into smaller molecules, what kind of process is that? That is catabolism, and it releases energy. So glucose to pyruvate is what? Exergonic or endergonic? It is exergonic, so it is releasing energy. So you might actually want to put a little arrow sticking out right here saying it's producing energy. It's an exergonic reaction, right? And we're going to see what it's producing when that happens. So that process in the cytoplasm is called glycolysis because it's built off of the word glyco, which means what? Glucose. And what does lysis mean? It means breaking apart, right? When you break something apart, like hemolysis is breaking a cell apart, glycolysis is breaking glucose apart. That releases energy when it produces pyruvic acid. All right, now there's a really important molecule that's left off this slide that I want you to know, and I'm not going to tell you what it is, but there is probably the most important molecule that is being produced by all of these things and is the point of this respiratory scheme right here. So I want somebody to tell me sometime soon. Okay, and if you see it already, that's fantastic. Okay, the molecule that's left off of this really important scheme is the purpose of all of this stuff, why we're going to spend a couple weeks looking at this, because it produces ATP for us. All right, so since glycolysis is exergonic, that energy then is going to be used to make ATP. So eventually we want to see, where does ATP come from in all of these different metabolic pathways? All right, pyruvic acid has a couple fates. It can enter a mitochondria under certain conditions, or it can be converted into lactic acid. So let's consider going into the mitochondria first. If oxygen is available, pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria. And then it's converted into an intermediate that enters the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle then breaks that pyruvic acid down, and it produces CO2. And then what do you do with CO2? You exhale it out of your body, right? So that CO2 basically came from this glucose, and you're breaking those chemical reactions, right? You're breaking that pyruvic acid down into CO2. Is that exergonic or endergonic? That is exergonic again. So the Krebs cycle is highly exergonic, and guess what your body does with that energy that is produced by the Krebs cycle? All right, so again, you could like put a little arrow out saying it's exergonic, it's producing energy. All right, it's making ATP for you. All right, so in the process of doing that, there are high energy electrons that are produced within the Krebs cycle, and then they're transported within the mitochondria to another set of enzymes that we call the electron transport chain. All right, and oxygen has to be available for mitochondria to do this. And then the electrons, all right, move through various carriers, and in so doing, ATP is produced, a lot of ATP. And as a result, CO2 is produced and water as well. All right, so we call this aerobic respiration inside the mitochondria because what's the molecule that's necessary? Maybe you could put it out over here with an arrow going in. Oxygen, you need oxygen entering these mitochondria. All right, and then right here, this electron transport, we learned, what do we call a substance that can take a molecule or some entity from one set of chemical reactions to another? It's a large organic molecule that can take coenzymes, okay? So what coenzymes did we learn about that can actually accept electrons and carry these electrons around inside the cell or within the mitochondria? Take high-energy electrons from one set of metabolic reactions to a second set of metabolic reactions, NAD plus and FADH, right? FADH. All right, so that's what's carrying these high energy electrons around. So there's a lot of really good important information on this introductory slide right here. All right, so aerobic respiration takes place where inside your body? In mitochondria. That's where it takes place. All right, so that's obligatory. Mitochondria can only do their job if oxygen is present. As a matter of fact, pyruvic acid cannot even enter a mitochondria without oxygen being present. Okay. All right, the other reaction that we haven't talked about yet, which we see here under which we call anaerobic respiration, some pyruvic acid, all right, under anaerobic conditions, or pyruvic acid under anaerobic conditions, is converted to lactic acid. All right, and that just allows glycolysis to keep operating. What was one of the products of glycolysis that we talked about? I said put a little arrow here, right here. What kind of reaction is it? Endergonic or exergonic? It's exergonic reaction, right? So it's producing energy for your cell. All right, and if pyruvic acid were to build up, right, because of the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle, what would happen to glycolysis if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell because it can't get into the mitochondria? It stops, and then you stop that exergonic reaction and you can't make any ATP. So what the cell does, it gets rid of pyruvic acid so that glycolysis can still take place under anaerobic conditions. Lactic acid is produced, and then lactic acid actually can diffuse out of the cell and go back to the liver, and the liver has a really fancy way of making glucose out of it. Okay, but it takes some energy to do that. So under anaerobic conditions, glycolysis does not stop because pyruvic acid gets converted to lactic acid. All right, so that's the nice introductory slide. Let's look at some of these individual pieces on this slide. And I understand that you can't learn all of this all at one time. So I'm going to talk about it, and then you got to go back and study it, and then look at this slide again, and then go back and look at it some more, and piece it together. All right, so that first process where we break glucose down is glycolysis. All right, so what's a simple way of thinking of glycolysis? What is glycolysis doing? It's taking like a pair of scissors and snipping glucose in half, right? And in so doing, it's producing some energy. All right, so glycolysis is a metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into two pyruvates. Pyruvate has three carbons, does not require oxygen. Because where does glycolysis take place? Where in the cell does glycolysis operate? In the cytoplasm, not mitochondria, right? It's a really ancient form of getting energy from glucose. All right, here's the overall net reaction. We have glucose plus 2NAD, and remember, NAD is a cation. You should probably put a plus right there, plus 2 ADPs, plus a couple of inorganic phosphates. That's going to produce 2 pyruvates because we split glucose in half. And in so doing, we get 2 ATPs out of this process right here. That's a good thing, right? That's everybody's got to be everybody's favorite molecule, all right? Except for maybe NADH. That should be pretty important on your scale too, right? Glycolysis produces 2 NADH. Now, what could you tell me about this NADH right here? What's it carrying around? High energy electrons. So these high energy electrons in NADH, right, can actually be used to make even more ATP later on when we look at that. All right, so glycolysis is not only making ATP, but some NADHs as well. All right, so glycolysis is exergonic, and that energy then is used to make ATP and NADHs. So in order to make ATP, what do you need? You need ADP plus inorganic phosphate. All right, going to ATP. And what kind of delta G is that? That's a positive, right? That's a positive delta G. That's a kind of a sloppy delta right there. All right, but what is that entity that we should not forget about? It's contained in that delta G. What's that entity that you can't measure with a scale like you can with ADP, inorganic phosphate, or ATP? It is energy. So where would we want to put energy on this equation right here? We're over here with the reactants, right? So we got energy right here plus ADP plus PI making ATP. Now, where does this energy come from? It comes from glycolysis, breaking glucose down into pyruvate. All right, that's where that energy comes from. All right, so let's look at the next slide. All right, so here is a plot of free energy versus just the process of the metabolic pathway we call glycolysis. And we can see that there are a number of steps involved, and that's really not the whole reaction, that's just a couple of the reactions. All right, so glucose enters the cell. What's the first thing that happens to glucose? What's this first step right here? It requires an ATP, and it phosphorylates glucose. So it goes from glucose to glucose 6-phosphate. That means that the sixth position on the carbon atom has been phosphorylated. What kind of enzyme is necessary to go from glucose to glucose 6-phosphate right here? Was that a phosphatase or a kinase? Which one adds a phosphate to something? A kinase, yeah, so that would be glucose 6-kinase. Adds a phosphate, right? And so now you have that big hydrophobic group added to glucose and that inorganic phosphate with a bunch of charges on it. What does that do in terms of the membrane solubility of glucose 6-phosphate? Does it make it easier or harder for glucose to leave the cell since it's been phosphorylated? And now it has a bunch of hydrophilic groups on it, or at least one at the moment. What moves through a membrane? Hydrophobic molecules or hydrophilic molecules? The hydrophobic molecules move across, but since glucose now has been phosphorylated, it's even more hydrophilic, so now glucose is really trapped inside the cell. Okay, so that's the way that cells are kind of greedy. Once they get glucose, they don't ever give it up, because we're going to see why in just a second, because it can be broken down and releases energy. All right, so one ATP is used up, and then another ATP is used up. So now we've got like a glucose 1,6-diphosphate. All right, so now 2-phosphate molecules are added to it. So that costs the cell some energy, and now, and we can see the free energy of that glucose phosphate, glucose diphosphate, what, it continues to go up, and now then it is broken down. And as it breaks, so this is what, an endergonic part of glycolysis, and then this descending limb right here is what, the exergonic part of glycolysis. And in so doing, when glucose is broken down, 2 NAD pluses are converted into 2 NADHs in this step over here, and then there are 2 other additional steps that produce ATP. Right, so here is a large exergonic reaction that makes some high energy electron carriers and 4 molecules of ATP because it's exergonic. And the energy that's released, some of it ends up in these molecules right here. All right, so what's the net gain of ATP for glycolysis? Just think net in terms of like the high energy electrons, but just strictly in terms of ATP. It is 2 because 4 are produced, but remember it takes 2 to get this process started. So there's a net gain of 2 ATPs for glycolysis. So just think of splitting it into 2 molecules. So here is glycolysis. And I forget, did I make this an exam figure for you guys or not? I'm not sure. Do you have to write out glycolysis this semester? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And I forget how I did it this semester. Maybe I didn't. Okay. But nonetheless, you should know that you start out with glucose, which is what, 6 carbons, and it's broken down into 2 3-carbon units right here. And this is a highly exergonic overall reaction, and that energy is used to make 2 ATPs and also 2 NADHs, which are carrying high energy electrons from glycolysis to another set of chemical reactions someplace else inside the cell. And you can kind of look at these rearrangements right here, but maybe that's not so important for your class. All right, just look at the end of chapter questions to be sure, and any online questions, and your exam figures to make sure that you know the right material for the test. All right, so that's glycolysis. So what are some other things you should know about glycolysis? We see that NADH is used up to make NADH. Right? Is oxygen necessary for this metabolic pathway? No, it's not. And where does it take place inside the cell? Cytoplasm, not in mitochondria. Right. Okay. All right. So let's look at this reaction right here. Pyruvic acid. Where do you get pyruvic acid from? Yeah. It's a end product of glycolysis. Right. Okay, and now let's just say, well, let's go back to this slide right here. Pyruvic acid, under normal conditions, can enter mitochondria, as well as NADH can enter the mitochondria. So it's taken out of the cytoplasm, and as you take pyruvic acid out of the cytoplasm, what can you help tell me about the rate of glycolysis? Does it slow down, or does it kind of speed up if you take pyruvic acid out of the cytoplasm? It speeds it up, right? Just by the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. And if you take NADH out of the cytoplasm and put it into mitochondria when there's oxygen, Can you see that that promotes glycolysis? That does not inhibit glycolysis? All right, now let's do the reverse of that. Say, under anaerobic conditions, when there's no oxygen, so pyruvic acid can't enter mitochondria, NADH cannot enter mitochondria, it starts to build up inside the cell. So what will happen to glycolysis under those conditions? And here is a hint. When you look at step number 7 right here, how many different arrows do you see and which way are they pointing? There are two arrows, they're pointing in opposite directions. So that means that these intermediates can interconvert one way or the other depending on the law of mass action. Right, so as NADH builds up inside the cell, that inhibits glycolysis and maybe even forces it to run backwards. And in so doing, right, what happens to ATP production then if glycolysis runs backwards? It stops. And does your brain need ATP? Yeah. If your brain stops making ATP, how long do you have? What time can you maintain consciousness? About 2 seconds. Okay, and then about 2 minutes, then your brain is dead, right? So that's, you don't really want to inhibit glycolysis, right? That's a pretty important reaction. Even though it's only producing a measly 2 ATP, that's better than nothing. Probably can't maintain consciousness, but that might keep your brain alive anyway until you're resuscitated. All right, so if there's no oxygen, your body has figured out a way to get rid of pyruvic acid and to get rid of NADH. And this is the reaction. It's called the lactic acid pathway. All right, so to avoid end product inhibition and also to deplete NADHs and pyruvate from inside the cytoplasm, we have an enzyme called lactate dehydrogenase that takes pyruvic acid as well as NADH. And what do you have in NADH right here? Some high energy electrons, which can be transferred to pyruvate, and when it does, it's converted into lactic acid. All right, so that's a lactate dehydrogenase pathway. We sometimes call this anaerobic respiration or a fermentation pathway. Right? Anaerobic respiration and fermentation are pretty much synonyms. And so what does that do? That gets rid of pyruvic acid and gets rid of NADH so that you don't have inhibition of glycolysis. Right? But what else do you need for glycolysis to take place? You need NAD+. So what does the lactate fermentation pathway also produce? Not only does it get rid of NADH for you, but it also produces NAD+, so that glycolysis has plenty of intermediates so that it can operate, and when it does, it produces some ATP for you. All right, so this reaction right here happens in the cytoplasm, all right, or in the cytosol. It's probably a better way of saying it, cytosol. So in the absence of oxygen, NADH is replenished into NAD, right, and pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid. And sometimes we call that a fermentation pathway or anaerobic respiration. All right, so that doesn't give you a lot of ATP, but at least 2 for every glucose molecule. Oh, the other thing is this lactic acid then doesn't build up inside the cell. It can actually leave the cell, go into the blood where liver takes it up and converts it back into glucose. And the way it converts it back into glucose is that it converts it into pyruvic acid, and then pyruvic acid running the reverse of glycolysis, the liver can make glucose out of it again. Okay, and then the liver can store it or put it back in the blood. All right, so this lactic acid pathway only yields a net gain of 2 ATPs for glucose via glycolysis. All right, red blood cells are kind of funny cells. They don't have any organelles. They don't have a nucleus. They don't have mitochondria. But they do have a requirement for ATP to stay alive, and your cells, your red blood cells, stay alive by running this lactic acid pathway. Okay, and the lactic acid pathway is important in skeletal and heart muscle. When oxygen levels fall below a critical level, that helps maintain ATP. All right, but pH drops, lactic acid might build up in muscle cells. That produces a very uncomfortable feeling, right, and pain. And that produces some pain inhibition of using those muscles then, but at least it keeps them alive. And whenever a muscle contracts, all right, it just turns into what? When a muscle contracts, it turns into from a relatively flaccid tissue into what? Something that is rock solid, okay? And if it's rock solid, blood can't get into it, And then those mitochondria can't make ATP. They run out of oxygen, and that's when the lactic acid pathway builds up. So when it, have you ever had a cramp in a muscle? Okay. And so what's happening there? Did you walk around saying, oh, look at that big solid rock right there? You're really proud of that, that muscle that's gone into a tonic contraction? No. What are you doing? You're hyperventilating and dancing around, doing other things with different parts of your body, trying to get that muscle to relax because how does it feel? Hurts like hell, actually, right? And that's because of the buildup of lactic acid and changes of pH inside that muscle. Okay, so that's why you want that cramp to go away, and then muscle, then the blood can go back into the muscle and bring oxygen, and things get straightened out again. All right, so we learned a little bit about glycolysis, which is the breakdown of glucose into pyruvic acid. Right, there's a couple other terms that you're really going to have to make sure you have your reading glasses on, if you need reading glasses, to understand these different terms. And make sure you know how to spell them and develop a pretty good facility with understanding what these different terms mean. So glycolysis is what? Breaking glucose down. We also have glycogenesis. What the heck is glycogenesis? What does genesis mean right here? It means making something. What's it making? It's making glycogen. All right, so taking glucose, and muscle cells do this to some degree, liver is really good at doing this. Glycogenesis is making glucose from what molecule? Glucose. Glucose is the building block of glycogen. So liver cells, muscle cells can take excess glucose when you don't need a lot of ATP, when you're in a resting state. It can take glucose and it makes glycogen out of it. That process is called glycogenesis. All right? And then at other times when your body needs to make ATP, it needs to have glucose available, it breaks glycogen down. So if glycolysis breaks glucose down, what's the term for breaking glycogen down? Then that would be glycogenolysis. So glycogenolysis is breaking glycogen down. For instance, when your blood glucose levels start to decrease, your blood glucose is running low. Where does it get glucose from? Your body gets it from the liver. The liver then starts to open up glycogenolysis pathways that break glycogen down into glucose, and that glucose ends up in the blood, maintaining glucose homeostasis. All right, so why do we have glycogen? Well, for osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucoses. Because what happens to the size of a cell if all of a sudden we start adding glucose particles to it? What about, think in terms of osmotic pressure. So we're increasing the solute concentration inside the cell. Right, if we start to put thousands or millions of glucose molecules inside the cell, what happens to the cell? Since the water concentration is decreasing because glucose's concentration is going way up, then we have osmosis inside the cell and the cell could burst, it could rupture. So the way that cells prevent that from happening is that it can take thousands of glucose molecules and makes one molecule out of it, thus erasing that osmotic gradient. So osmotic pressure is reduced or is eliminated, so the cell stays the same shape. It has the same number of glucose molecules, but they're what? They're all attached to each other, so it's only one big molecule. So that prevents the cell from exploding. All right, so instead, glucose is stored as glycogen. So taking glucose, converted into glycogen, is glycogenesis. All right, so skeletal muscle and liver can do that. And then when blood glucose levels decrease, then the opposite reaction takes place, especially in the liver. We call that glycogenolysis. Because the liver can export glucose to the blood, but muscle cells can't. Once a muscle absorbs the glucose, then it's stuck inside that cell. And remember, that phosphate group, those first couple steps in glycolysis, when glucose is phosphorylated, that especially traps these glucose molecules inside most cells so that it can't move across the membrane. All right, so here's a table of important terms that I want you to know from this chapter. Glycolysis is what? The breaking down of glucose into two pyruvates. Glycogenesis is the production of glycogen from where? From glucose. Okay, and then glycogenolysis is the production of glucose from glycogen. And then here is one that we haven't talked about, but I showed you, and that is gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis is similar to, well, let's think about glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. What can you tell me about glycogenesis and glycogenolysis? They are opposite pathways, right? One is making glycogen, the other is breaking it down. The same thing for glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. Glycolysis breaks glucose down, but gluconeogenesis is the reverse of that process that produces glucose from pyruvate or other three-carbon intermediates along that glycolysis metabolic pathway. So let me see if I can flip back just a couple slides without, this is not bad. All right, so glycolysis is the solid arrows, right, moving from glucose to pyruvic acid. And what do these dotted arrows represent? That would be gluconeogenesis, because it's taking three-carbon molecules, fusing them together to make glucose. All right, but if glycolysis produces ATP, guess what gluconeogenesis does? It uses up ATP. Okay, that does use up ATP. All right, so make sure you know how to pronounce those words and recognize them, right, if they're on a test. Make sure you don't get them mixed up. Okay, lipogenesis. That is the making of lipids, like a triglyceride. You know how to make a triglyceride. What kind of chemical reaction would you use? Like a dehydration synthesis reaction with glycerol and three fatty acids? Right, that would be lipogenesis. Or the reverse, the hydrolysis reaction we call lipolysis. And somebody had a question on an online question. What about lipolysis? Is lipolysis the catabolism of a fatty acid, or is it the catabolism of a triglyceride? It's very particular. And when we say catabolism, what do we mean? Breaking it down. Okay? Breaking it down into smaller molecules. So if you have a triglyceride and break it down into smaller molecules, what do you get out of it? Can you remember that? You get three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule. That's what lipolysis actually produces. Okay? But the major energy reaction when we break lipids down is when we break fatty acids down into carbon dioxide. And that's what we call beta oxidation, which is different than lipolysis. Lipolysis is just breaking down of a triglyceride. It doesn't produce a lot of energy like beta oxidation, which is the last thing that we're going to talk about in this class. And then maybe we'll talk about ketogenesis sometime during this chapter. Okay, but it's going to make ketone bodies, right? So genesis is the making of ketone bodies right here. All right, so let's use some of these terms. Here's a really important exam figure, and it's not labeled in your book really well, so you got to take really good notes with this one right here. What do we got on this slide? Well, we got glycogen. What's the building block of glycogen? Glucose. And we see that it's being broken down into glucose 1-phosphate. So it has to be phosphorylated in order for that to happen. And what is the name of this metabolic pathway that takes glycogen and produces glucose? That is, it's starting with glycogen, so it's glycogen with the, what do we call breaking down something? Lysis, glycogenolysis, right? So number two is glycogenolysis. I'm not sure that key is in your book anywhere. All right, what about if you take glucose and make glycogen out of it? Number one right here. What is that called? When you make glycogen from glucose, glycogenesis, right? The making of glycogen. All right, so make sure you know those two. Now, when you take this phosphate off of glucose, what kind of enzyme is used to take a phosphate off of glucose to make glycogen? That's a phosphatase, right? So glucose 1-phosphatase is used to make glycogen, and which one takes glucose and adds a phosphate to it? That would be a kinase enzyme, right? So now you know some of these enzymes, and they can be controlled via allosteric regulation, maybe even under certain hormone control that we're going to look at later on in the course. All right, then glucose with a little rearrangement, so the phosphate hops from the number 1 carbon to the number 6 carbon, right? And this right here represents a liver cell, okay? Well, actually, it could be any kind of cell, but think in terms of a liver cell. All right, and then glucose, 6-phosphate, the phosphate can be cleaved from it with another, what, phosphatase enzyme, glucose-6-phosphatase makes a glucose out of it, and the liver has the ability to take that glucose and export it out of the cell into the blood. Right, so that glucose then can go to other tissues like the heart or muscle or brain that needs glucose to make ATP. So the liver is kind of altruistic. It can take glucose from glycogen and give it to other organs that need glucose to, in order to make ATP. Right? But the liver can also, or other organs, other tissues, can take glucose-6-phosphate and run it through glycolysis to make ATP. Right? Now, if you're in a fed state, your blood glucose levels are rising because you're absorbing glucose from nutrients that you've eaten. And the liver can take glucose from the blood. So what happens to blood glucose concentration as tissues absorb it? It goes down, right? So that's just a way of maintaining homeostasis as blood glucose starts to go up, right? And then cells take it up, glucose goes down. What kind of feedback is that? That's negative feedback, right? So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So the liver takes this glucose up, and when you're in a fed state, then the liver uses glycogenesis to put it into glycogen, to store it until you're in a fasted state. All right, so this is a pretty handy little diagram right here. All right, so number one is what? Glycogenesis. Number two is glycogenolysis. And then what the heck is glycolysis? The breakdown of glucose. Okay, where does that happen? In the cytoplasm of cells. Okay, so there's a nice interaction between, say, skeletal muscles and liver. Right, some skeletal muscles, when they're working very, very fast or when they go into tonic contraction, remember, they operate anaerobically and they produce a lot of pyruvic acid that's going to inhibit glycolysis. And so that pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid inside exercising muscles. And I suppose if that lactic acid builds up, that could stop glycolysis from operating. But cells can export lactic acid into the blood. And it goes into the blood, and blood goes everywhere, including the liver. And then the liver sees that lactic acid, and it converts it into pyruvic acid. Right? And then the liver has the ability to take pyruvic acid and make glucose out of it. What is this pathway? Number six, what is pyruvate going to glucose called? And it's the new production of glucose. The new production of glucose from these three carbon fragments right here is called gluconeogenesis, right? It's the production of new glucose, not the production of glucose from glycogen, but from these three carbon fragments right here. All right, so I do want you to know the names of these different pathways. So what would number seven be? Glucose-6-phosphate to plain old glucose. Is that a kinase or a phosphatase? That's a phosphatase. And what's the substrate that phosphatase works on? It is glucose-6-phosphate. And so we just name that enzyme after the substrate. So that would be glucose-6-phosphatase, right? Makes glucose. Glucose, then the liver can put it in the blood, enters the cell. What's the first thing that most cells do? They use up an ATP and phosphorylate that glucose so it can't run away. What takes glucose and turns it into glucose-6-phosphate? That would be glucose-6-phosphokinase, right? A kinase phosphorylates. And then depending on what this cell is doing, if it's exercising, it needs to make ATP. What's one way that you know how to make ATP from glucose now? With glycolysis, right? So here is, so number two is glycolysis, making pyruvic acid. And then if it's anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid. What's the enzyme number three right here? That is LDH or lactate dehydrogenase, right? Because this is an oxidation reduction reaction. Electrons are being transferred, right? But if the cell is not exercising, what does it do with this glucose-6-phosphate? Converts it to glycogen. So what would number nine be? What's the production of glycogen called? That is glycogenesis. All right, but now let's just say you start exercising that muscle again and it wants glucose really fast. Where can it get it from? Glycogen. So breaking down glycogen to glucose, what's number one? That is the breaking down of glycogen. What do you do when you break something down? You lyse it, so that is glycogenolysis, right? Glycogenolysis. So make sure you can name each of these little arrows right here. But these long arrows in the blood, that we don't have a special name for that. That's just blood flow between a couple different organs. So that just shows you a nice interplay of how the liver works with various other organs in your body to make sure that they have a nice constant supply of glucose. Okay, we call that the Cori cycle. And this can also happen with some other intermediates besides lactic acid, like maybe some amino acids and glycerol. Now, how many carbons does glycerol have? Can anybody remember? 3. So you see, it's a very similar molecule to what? Lactic acid and pyruvic acid, so it's easy for our cells to interconvert these different compounds because they're all 3 carbon molecules. Not so if there's a different number of carbons on them. All right, so that's a good exam figure. All right, so let's switch to aerobic respiration. Now, where does aerobic respiration begin? Look at that very first slide. Can I go back without getting too dizzy? This one right here. Where does aerobic respiration begin? This thing that looks more yellow down here. All right, so maybe just put a bracket pointing to what? O2. So pyruvic acid can enter mitochondria if there is oxygen available. And then aerobic respiration can take place. So aerobic respiration takes place in the mitochondria. And there are 3 main reactions. 2 of them are listed on this slide. One is the Krebs cycle. The second one is electron transport. The third one that's not on this slide right here is actually the first one. And it's what I call a preparatory reaction. So it's a preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. All right, so let's go back to aerobic. Hopefully by next time I'll have this slide to put on the other screen. Okay, so aerobic respiration begins when pyruvate, formed from glycolysis, right, enters mitochondria. Under what conditions? Well, under aerobic conditions, when there's plenty of oxygen inside the cell. All right, 1 carbon dioxide is clipped off of pyruvate. So if we start with 3 carbons that pyruvate has, here's pyruvic acid, 1, 2, 3 carbons. And if we clip off a carbon to make a CO2, how many carbons are we left with? We're left with 2, all right? All right, so CO2 is clipped off. The 2 remaining carbons are added to coenzyme A. Now, what can you tell me about coenzymes? Big, hideous organic molecules, right? You never want to really memorize their shape or calculate their molecular weight because it's a big organic molecule. And what's the job of a coenzyme? It's going to transfer something from one metabolic pathway to another. And so what it's transferring is what we call an acetyl group. An acetyl group is a 2-carbon fragment, 1, 2. It's carrying this 2-carbon fragment from glycolysis to the Krebs cycle. That's its whole job. All right, so coenzyme A not only breaks off a CO2, which then you breathe out of your body, but it produces acetyl coenzyme A. That acetyl group is this 2-carbon fragment right here. And what do you do with this CO2? You exhale it right out of your body, right? That's why we exhale. All right, so what organelle produces CO2 in your body? Mitochondria does. Okay, so that's another important take-home message. Now you see something else happening here. Not only do you understand something now about coenzymes, but what other kind of reaction is taking place? Look at this right here. NAD is a coenzyme. What's it doing? It's being reduced to NADH, so it's accepting some high-energy electrons. So what is this reaction right here? This is what the... So this is an oxidation-reduction reaction. As NADH becomes reduced, this acetyl group becomes oxidized, right? It's given up some high energy electrons to NAD plus to make NADH. All right, now that has a special color because mitochondria do something with NADH in a little bit, which we'll get to. Maybe not today, all right, but we'll get to it pretty soon. NADH has got high energy compounds, those electrons that your cell does not waste. All right, so we see CO2, a waste product, and now we got acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA then can, so here's the membrane of the mitochondria, right? Here's glycolysis producing pyruvic acid. Now, when can pyruvic acid enter a mitochondria? Under aerobic conditions. Here's the preparatory reaction where a CO2 is cleaved off and NADH is produced. And then a coenzyme A has been conjugated with an acetyl group, and we call that then an acetyl coenzyme A, carrying the C2 fragment to the Krebs cycle. All right, so this is like the third reaction in that slide that we were looking at. The Krebs cycle has a number of intermediates that flip between four carbons and six carbons, and then there's some decarboxylations. Remember, we learned about carboxylic acids, and it gets converted back to a four-carbon molecule, and then that cycle can repeat itself over and over again as long as it has an input of acetyl-CoA. So coenzyme A takes an acetyl group into the Krebs cycle, donates that two-carbon fragment to oxaloacetic acid, so that converts oxaloacetic acid from four carbons to what? A six-carbon molecule. I don't think you have to know the names of these things. This is not an exam figure, but you got to get the flow of what's happening. All right, and then there are other interconversions and decarboxylations that take place, converting citric acid back to oxaloacetic acid. And since it's breaking that acetyl group down, producing these two carbon dioxides, that's an exergonic reaction. So the Krebs cycle is, we mentioned that before, is highly exergonic. And so what can your body do with exergonic reactions? It can take that energy that's being produced and it can be used to what? Make ATP out of it, to put ADP and inorganic phosphate back together again. All right, so let's look at some of the details. I do want you to know some of the details. This is just kind of a nice flow diagram. All right, the Krebs cycle, from one turn of the Krebs cycle, produces on the next slide the following things. But before we get to that slide, how many turns does the Krebs cycle make for every glucose? What happened? How many pyruvates do you get from one glucose? You get two, so you get two turns of the Krebs cycle for every glucose. So there might be a factor of two that you're going to have to take into consideration as we look at the Krebs cycle. All right, so the Krebs cycle produces, for just one turn, right, for every pyruvic acid, one guanosine triphosphate. All right, and guanosine triphosphate basically has the same free energy as ATP. So what can you make from one GTP? Very easily, you can make an ATP molecule out of it, right? But strictly, Krebs is making a GTP, which ends up as an ATP. It produces three NADHs, right? What is NADH carrying? High energy electrons, two of them, as a matter of fact, and it can make one FADH2, which again is a coenzyme that's carrying high energy electrons, almost the same energy as NADH, but not quite. All right, so these coenzymes right here, NADH and FADH2, then carry those electrons to the last metabolic pathway on that first slide, which is called the electron transport chain. So where we're going to start next time is just starting to review the Krebs cycle, all right, to make sure that you can see where these NADHs are produced, where the decarboxylations are, and then we get into the last part of aerobic respiration. So hopefully I have some pre-lecture reading assignments for you. Oh, I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around, did I? Oh, I did. Who's got it? Wave it really quick. It's up there? Yeah, it's going to come back down. Okay, so see you Thursday. And I think in lab you get to talk about some of these concepts too. So if you have questions with your pre-lecture reading assignments, end of chapter questions, make sure you talk to your lab instructor or each other during lab. Okay.